Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau, and I am your host. My work is dedicated to empowering people to live according to their own values of compassion and wellness. You can learn more about who I am and what I do by visiting my website, joyfulvegan.com. Hi, everybody. It is lovely to be here. It is a gorgeous day today, this early September day, and it's Labor Day weekend, and I hope you're going to have a wonderful weekend. By the time you hear this, you'll be well into your weekend. I am doing well. My mother has left, and I am glad. It is nice to be alone again, frankly. I commend people who take care of others in general, just because it's a lot of work just looking out for someone else's well-being. And she's great. She's good. She's going to be staying in New Jersey. We're going to be moving her into her partner's house, and I'll be going back to New Jersey to help her with that. But that said, it was really nice to be able to get some work done. I didn't get work done for 2 weeks, which is really hard for me. And I full on just was dedicated to taking care of my mom and spending time with her. So we did that, and it was great. And now it's great to be back to work. I definitely have been having hand pain, and I am starting to use more voice recognition apps, and it's definitely helping. So most of this podcast was actually written verbally, which is ironic since I was writing it for an oral medium. So I have been really excited to get this episode to you. Just a couple more announcements. I have been talking to you about Sicily. I've been teasing you about it. And I'm sorry to say that I'm actually not going to be doing the trip. I thought about it long and hard, and I just didn't think it was the right thing to do for a number of reasons. Nothing dramatic, but I decided not to go ahead with it. So I won't be hosting a trip in 2016, at least as far as I know. There is something still in the works that I'm thinking about. I won't tease you with anything else. But right now, I just wanted to let you know that you won't be hearing any announcements about Sicily because I won't be doing that. However, I will be traveling a lot the rest of this year. I have a lot of travel coming up for different veg fests and events. And you can go to joyfulvegan.com to find out where I'll be. I'll tell you where I'll be. I'll be in Chicago. I'll be in Atlanta. I'll be in New York, specifically upstate, up at Farm Sanctuary for their Thanksgiving event. I'll be in Portland, and I will be in Ireland. I'm not really sure exactly the dates I'll be there. Well, I know I'll be there in November, but I'm not sure exactly when I'll be in Dublin versus any other part of the country. But check out my website all the time. The events page always has updates of my talks and my events. Let's see, another announcement, which is really exciting. I've told you to check me out on Periscope. I've been doing a lot more live broadcasts, and I think you'll enjoy them because it's really an opportunity for me to talk to you in between this 2 week period between podcast episodes. And I do make a lot of announcements there, and it's a chance to talk to you directly and answer your questions, etc. One of the things I had mentioned in a recent Periscope video is that a new partnership has emerged, which is really super exciting. Many of you have heard of the documentary film Cowspiracy, which talks about the basically the environmental effects of the animal agriculture industry and how the major environmental organizations basically ignore animal agriculture as the main culprit in environmental degradation. And it's a great documentary, and it's getting a lot of attention. And many of you may have heard that Leonardo DiCaprio, actor, activist, has signed on as an executive producer, and it's going to be premiering on Netflix on September 15th. And one of the things that I've always felt so strongly about is so many of these documentaries that talk about the ill effects of meat, dairy, and eggs don't have then a call to action for people to then want to do something about it. And so the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, of course, is always the answer to any of the I don't want to be part of this. How do I do this? How do I become vegan? Of course, it's the answer to that. It's the guide for that. And now it will be one of the official calls to action on the Cowspiracy website, encouraging people to take the 30-Day Vegan Challenge. So we've created a version for the Cowspiracy website, and I'm really excited about it. It could mean a lot of attention for the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, mostly meaning that people will take the challenge and hopefully be inspired to become and stay vegan. So that's exciting news. You can find out more of those kinds of tidbits and announcements if you follow me in all sorts of social media, including Periscope. One of the things I'm also working on right now is the Daily Dose of Compassion, which will be a daily email of messages of compassion from me. And so if you're on the mailing list at joyfulvegan.com, we will start transferring that over. And I invite you to go to joyfulvegan.com to join the mailing list. lots of good stuff, lots of fantastic stuff. And thank you, everybody who listens and who supports this work. Thank you to everyone who supports at every level. You can become a supporter of my work at patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau, or you could just go to joyfulvegan.com and find the link there. And your support makes this work possible. We have two new gold members, and I'm going to read you a letter by one of them, which is so incredibly moving. The end. I know you're probably listening to this right now, you, the writer of the letter, but the end quite literally made me gasp with emotion. It's so beautiful. So Sharon Conley, thank you so much for your gold membership. And Ranjini Mohan, thank you so much for yours. And this letter is from Ranjini. She wrote, "I want to take this opportunity to thank you personally for the absolutely amazing and inspiring work you do. I was born in India and was raised as a vegetarian. I was always proud and maybe even complacent that my food choices did not support animal slaughter. I came to Indiana 4 years ago and was appalled by the fact that meat was the status quo. I stuck to my values despite my surroundings. But there was a shadow in my heart that said being vegetarian was just not enough. I struggled to understand what my spirit lacked. I wanted to actively prevent animal cruelty, but felt that it was out of my control. I wanted to change my life, but I just didn't know where to start. I spent the last 8 months voraciously engulfing all the digital and written information there was on animal welfare. That's when I watched a YouTube video of yours and found your podcast. I know everybody says this to you, but you have changed yet another life. Going vegan has been the best decision of my life, and I have never felt better. Finally, there was something I could do for the animals and my peace of mind every day, and it was under my control. Although I have only been a joyful vegan for 3 months, I rely on your wisdom and warmth to keep me going. My spirit feels connected to you somehow, and I can even feel my heart grow. I can write you a letter, but if the animals could write, they'd write you a poem. With most loving regards, Ranjini Mohan." Yeah, like that last line is just so beautiful, Ranjini. Thank you so, so much. I am so incredibly moved. And you are the one who changed your life. And of course, you're changing so many other lives because of that. So I'm just grateful to be part of your journey. And thank you for letting me. Thank you again, everybody. Go to joyfulvegan.com if you want to keep this podcast going. And if you want to continue to see lives changed, it's a really amazing thing. So I mentioned a couple podcast episodes ago that I would be reviewing a film for you. I've talked about this film quite a bit since I've seen it. I saw it a couple months ago in the theater. It's a Hungarian film called White God. Now, I want to make sure you don't confuse that. If you're aware of this, there was a 1982 film called White Dog. It was a Samuel Fuller film, and it was based on a novel, which was actually based on a true story about an actress in Los Angeles who finds a stray dog and comes to find out that this white dog had been trained to attack and kill only black people. And in the film, an African-American man tries to cure the dog of this racism. I have seen this film White Dog, totally different film than White God, but it definitely has an 80s vibe to it. Christy McNichols is one of the stars of it, if you remember her, those of you who are of my generation. And it definitely still, it feels a little 80s, a little dated, but it's an incredibly powerful film, in my opinion. It's really intriguing, really powerful. I'm a fan of Samuel Fuller. If you've never seen Pick Up on South Street, I highly recommend it, and other films of his, and I definitely recommend White Dog. Unfortunately, even though the film has a very clear anti-racist message, it was pulled by studio executives because it was deemed by the NAACP at the time to be promoting a racist message, and it's absolutely the opposite of that. So it was buried for decades, and it was buried when Samuel Fuller was aware that it was buried, and it was a real shame because it really is an anti-racist film. But thanks to Criterion Collection, it's been re-released, so now it can be seen by audiences worldwide. So that's White Dog. But today I'm going to talk about the movie White God. It's a 2014 movie directed by Cornel Mundruczo. I'm probably butchering that. Yes, butchering that name. Mundruczo. I think that's how we would say it. It's a Hungarian name. And it won the Un Certain Regard Prize at the 2014 Cannes Film Festival, which is a pretty high award. And the dogs in the film won the Palme d'Or Award, get it? It's a play on Palme d'Or, which is the festival's highest honor. And the Palme Dog Award, of course, is a very prestigious honor. So the dogs even won an award for this film. This was an award that started by the Cannes Film Festival in 2001. And it awards either live or animated dogs or group of dogs, canines, this award, this for the best performance. So the dogs also won an award. So I wanted to share this film with you because I love it so much. And also because I want to talk more in depth about the inclusion of animals in films. And I'm going to do that in the next podcast episode. I'm going to call it probably Animals in Film. In that episode, I'm going to talk about the inclusion of wild and domestic animals in film, if it's possible to do it humanely, the American Humane Association's role in the No Animals Were Harmed disclaimer that many of us see or we see at the end of many movies, and the history of that disclaimer, et cetera. But today I'd like to focus on this movie because I think it's incredibly powerful, and I think it's really important, and I think it's really beautiful, and I think it's a good jumping off point to talk about this larger issue of animals in film. One of the things that makes it so incredible is how multi-layered it is and how it is in so many ways a first of its kind and in so many ways part of a longer, older legacy of films. You can see in its DNA other films made over the last several decades, and yet in many ways it's so unique. And I just love it for that reason. I love it for so many reasons. I've seen the film 3 times now, and when I watch it, I see bits of movies such as, I've talked about Amores Perros, which is a Mexican film by the amazing director Alejandro González Iñárritu, I think that's the name, Iñárritu. His film was Amores Perros, and it's a really powerful film, also with some disturbing footage of dog fights, but also filmed in a way that no dogs were harmed in the making of it, even though some people saw that and thought that real dogs were being used for fighting, and I'm very much persuaded that they weren't in that film, and certainly not in White God. Another film it reminds me of, and it's been alluded to in reviews I've seen, is 28 Days Later by Danny Boyle. If you've seen that movie, it definitely has that texture to it. And I was even aware of this really cheesy 1984 film. I don't know if any of you saw this film, but I watched this film when I was a teenager. It's called Night of the Comet. Really cheesy film, you know, totally 80s. It's a zombie movie, which is interesting because zombie television shows and books are so popular right now, but it was a zombie movie. And there were just moments of White God that kind of reminded me of Night of the Comet, because there are a couple shots where the streets are totally empty in White God. And it looks like the entire human population has disappeared except for one girl. And that's kind of the way Night of the Comet is. Like, everybody disappears except these two girls who were in the mall, and somehow the comet didn't hit them and didn't hit the mall. And so they survived. Anyway, I will move on from that. But but it just kind of reminded me of that, because there's a scene in White God where it just looks like there's only one person left in this world. And it's pretty cool. So I'd be interested to hear from you about what films you see when you watch White God. I know the director himself has talked about his love of Fassbinder films, the German director Fassbinder. And though I've seen a couple Fassbinder films, I haven't seen enough to really see that influence in White God. I wouldn't be able to say so. But so not only do I see a lot of different films and kind of textures, White God also melds several genres. There's an absolute realism to the film, yet it has a science fiction aspect to it, particularly in its kind of apocalyptic texture and themes. At one point, it becomes a little like a horror movie. It has allegorical aspects to it. It's a revenge film, and it's also a coming-of-age film. And it's pretty remarkable to be able to hold all of these things at once and still hold its center, which is the story itself, which is a cautionary tale about our superiority over what we often consider, quote-unquote, the lesser beasts. At the center of the film is 13-year-old Lily, a young woman entering her adolescence, and of course, all the difficulties that naturally poses, and her dog, Hagen. Hagen is a mixed breed, and we come to find out that Hungary has recently passed a regulation, probably Budapest, the city in particular, but the regulation that has been passed basically imposes a really high tax on people who own mixed breed dogs rather than purebred dogs. And as a result, people are abandoning their dogs. So, of course, there are more homeless dogs on the streets and in the shelters. And so the shelters are overcrowded. There are homeless dogs running around the streets, gathering in these abandoned lots, etc. And so this new set of laws also has consequences for Lily, who is already a pawn in her parents' divorce. And so her mother goes out of the country for a couple months And she leaves Lily and Hagen with Lily's father, who's really upset that he has to take the dog in too. And it's clear that Lily and her father have a very strained relationship, you know, him not fully realizing that she's no longer a child. It's kind of one of the dynamics at play. Inevitably, we quickly see people who are against mixed breed dogs, including the animal control officer who comes to Lily's father's house, telling him that he must pay the fine or bring the dog to the shelter. And the father refuses to pay. And ultimately, in a fit of rage, most likely having more to do with his difficult relationship with Lily than any kind of hatred toward dogs, he throws Hagen out of the car, literally onto the streets. And of course, this just creates more animosity between Lily and her father, and she begins a quest to find Hagen. Sadly, Hagen is sold to an incredibly sadistic man who trains dogs for fighting and begins to abuse Hagen in order to make him mean enough to fight and, of course, kill. And this series of scenes is definitely the most difficult to watch in the film, but it's what takes place in order to brutalize someone into becoming violent, into becoming desensitized and violent. And it's really one of the reasons people ask me how I watch films about violence. You know, obviously I don't watch films where animals are being abused, but where, I mean, I do watch a lot of war films. I watch a lot of movies about violence, about human violence toward each other or toward other animals. And I do, because I think it's really important to understand it. I think it's really important to not turn away from it. And it's something I'm really interested in, our capacity to be violent and our capacity to become unviolent, which is kind of interesting that white dog is what I brought up in the very beginning, because can it be undone? And interestingly, an interviewer asked the director, Mundrukso, about the violence in White God. And here's what he had to say. The interviewer asked, there was a lot of violence in the film. How did you want people to receive it? And he said, violence is the black part of humans. In the middle of the film, there are some things which are tough to watch, but we need those things to be close to the truth. We can't step away. And I tend to agree. And of course, these films are beautifully shot in the sense that, I mean, they're brutal scenes. When I say beautifully shot, I mean really artistically shot. And you can tell that nobody's being hurt at all. So I don't want you to feel like I'm in any way promoting any animal being hurt, not in any way. But of course, there are the suggestions that he is being abused. The director and the cinematographer use shadows and certainly sound effects and sound editing. And it's what happens to these animals. And you can see that in Amores Perros as well. One of the other things I love about this film, and this is the whole film, is the soundscape of the film, but also the role music plays in this film. We learn early on that Lily is a musician. She's a trumpet player. It looks like her school is even a music school. So it looks like she even goes to a school that is a music school. And we come to see the power music has in her own life, but also in her relationship with Hagen. The first night Hagen is sleeping with her at her father's house, her father makes Hagen sleep in the bathroom by himself because he doesn't want this dirty dog, you know, quote unquote, in his bed or in his bedroom. And Hagen's in the bathroom all alone, and he cries and cries, and Lily says he's not used to being alone. And Lily goes into the bathroom, and she plays him a piece of music on her trumpet, and he is lulled to sleep. He's relaxed. And of course, because Budapest and Hungary are also main characters in this film, it's not a surprise that the music is Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody, and it's a beautiful piece. It's a beautiful moment in the Hungarian Rhapsody. So Hagen relaxes, and of course, once he relaxes, Lily crawls into the bathtub so she can sleep in the same room with Hagen. It's pretty incredible. So this scene will be even more significant by the end. Silence is a huge part of the film as well, not just music, and as I said, other sounds. The soundscape is just really powerful in this film. One of the things I love about this is because I think a central theme to this movie is communication. And so you see this, you see silence and language and soundscape and music all playing a significant role in the film. And I think so much of that has to do with communication or the lack thereof. I see how a breakdown in communication can lead to a breakdown of relationships, as in the case of Lily and her father. And you also see that a little bit. There's a moment we see Lily's mother and father interact, who are obviously getting a divorce or have already gotten a divorce. And you see them interact for a very brief, awkward moment. You can see there's no communication, no ability to communicate without being sarcastic or bitter. I see how individuals of different species can communicate so well with one another, as in the case of Lily and Hagen, juxtaposed, of course, with the fact that individuals of the same species cannot communicate at all. It's so clear that a dog and a girl, members of two different species, can communicate so much better than members of the same species and even of the same family. I think that's a real poignant theme that I saw in the movie. You also see how music can unite everyone. It can unite individuals and it can unite species. And we see that in the film. It's pretty powerful. We see that not only in the human music that Lily plays for Hagen, as I had just mentioned in the bathroom, but also in the animal music at the end of this film, specifically in the form of bird song. This bird song follows the human music. So this animal music follows the human music, and that bird song closes the film. And after that, I'm going to cry. I really remember. After that, there's complete, utter silence when the credits roll. And I have never seen a movie with such a dramatic climax close in such a quiet way. It's so beautiful. The director has talked very openly about how the movie is in some ways a metaphor for the majority's treatment of minorities, particularly in Hungary, and some people's attitude in Hungary, their chauvinistic attitude toward different people living in Hungary. And when I first saw some interviewers asking him about the metaphor, how this is a metaphor for our treatment of humans, one part of me kind of rolled my eyes a little bit, because so often I see stories about animals as only being taken as a metaphor and not being taken on its own merit, because of course the animals themselves are the minority who are mistreated by the majority, by humans, by the more powerful. And of course that is absolutely very clear and conscious and explicit in the film. So I do think both of those things are held in this movie, that it is an analogy, that it is a metaphor for the powerful's treatment of the disenfranchised. And it very much is in that same vein, that very realistic treatment of non-human animals by human animals. So here's how the producers summarize the film. Cornel Mundruczó's newest film is a story of the indignities visited upon animals by their supposed human superiors, but it's also a stark, beautiful metaphor for the political and cultural tensions sweeping contemporary Europe. So as I said, using animals as a metaphor for the oppressed and disenfranchised is very apropos, but of course, in other ways, it's not a metaphor at all. It's a very very real depiction of the chauvinism and anthropocentrism of humans and our treatment of non-human animals. As we know, non-human animals are often themselves oppressed and disenfranchised by humans. So it works on both levels. It's clearly an indictment against the human use and abuse of non-human animals. It's an indictment against the arbitrary classification of those within the species, right? Those who are acceptable and those who aren't. And it's an indictment against the abandonment and discarding of those that we find inconvenient or unacceptable based on these arbitrary standards or criteria that we create. And because of all of this, because of all of this happening at the same time, I don't believe that it's a coincidence that two of the characters in the film who are not, shall we say, embraced by the audience are very much the quintessential representatives of domination of one species over other species. One character works in a slaughterhouse, one character is a butcher. And of course, the other hated character in the film is a dog fighter. And actually, the other ones who are not well liked, in fact, every human who is not liked by the audience is someone who in some way, one way or another, either hurts animals directly or participates in their exploitation and death, like a butcher or a slaughterhouse worker, or someone who, in the case of the apartment neighbor who calls the authorities on Lily's father to say that he has a mixed breed in the house. And so all of these people are the ones that are the least liked, let's just say, by the audience, but also the dogs in the film. And you'll see what I mean by that. So I find it very interesting that in many ways, this is so very much a Hungarian film about Hungarian themes and people. And yet what makes films like this so effective and powerful is that it transcends its time and place. Of course, the themes of domination and abuse and cruelty and killing and communication and relationships, these are all universal themes. And ultimately, I think that's why this movie has received such critical acclaim. It's about all of these things at the same time. These are universal themes that transcend location and borders and race and religion and language language and even species. It's one of the reasons I talk about The Human Condition so much. This is another film that I've mentioned many times in the podcast. I mentioned it a couple podcasts ago. It's my favorite film, like, period. It's a Japanese film. It's a 9-hour long film that's broken up into three different parts, and it's incredibly beautiful. In many ways, it's quintessentially Japanese, but in many ways, it could have been made at any time about any place, not just about Japan during World War II. And that's what I think White God accomplishes. It addresses these universal themes in such a sensitive, thoughtful way, and it includes in that story the plight of non-human animals. From an animal rights perspective, and there is no doubt there is a conscious, intentional animal rights message here. There's no doubt about it. It gets to the heart, for me, of all the problems non-human animals face, and that is our perception that they are here for us to do with as we please, that they're here for us. For me, that's the heart of the problems with our relationship and our treatment of non-human animals, that we're superior and they're inferior, and thus we have a right to use and abuse them and exploit them and take their families and, you know, take their land, etc. And this film questions and criticizes that very premise, which is one of the reasons I'm so moved by it. When I was watching the film and drawing these parallels, I couldn't help but think of that wonderful quote by South African Nobel Prize winning writer J.M. Coetzee, which many of you have heard of and hopefully read. He wrote, among many other profound things, that the animal rights campaign remains a human project from beginning to end. And I think this is exactly what this film captures. It takes that one line and it makes a film out of it. Now, here's the really neat part. In doing my research for this podcast, I came to find out that Coetzee was the main influence for Manjukzo to make this film. Yes, if any of you speak Hungarian out there, please change my pronunciation, because I feel terrible. I'm sure I'm not doing a good job with the director's name. But Coetzee was the main influence in making this film. The director had read Coetzee's, I'll call him Cornell because it's easier. His name's Cornell. His first name's Cornell. Cornell had read Coetzee's 1999 novel Disgrace, which won the Booker Prize that year. And many of Coetzee's stories deal with the theme of exploitation, and animals and animal rights play a huge role in many of his stories. Most famously, in The Lives of Animals, which was written in 1999 or published in 1999, and in Elizabeth Costello, published in 2003. And Disgrace is no exception. I see so much of Coetzee in this film. And in fact, Cornell had said in interviews that he first saw the term white god in Coetzee's book Disgrace, which gave him the idea for the film. And here's what he said in an interview. Coming into contact with the literature of Coetzee was a revelatory experience. His works called attention to the fact that there is a layer below even the most outcast of all, consisting of another species of intelligent, rational beings that can be exploited in any manner by humans, animals. That's when I started wondering if it was possible to shoot a film with a dog. The task was as daunting as it was inspiring. So I just loved, like, it was so inspiring for me to see those connections between what I saw in terms of Coetzee having some kind of hand in this, or just I could just feel some of Coetzee in there. And then, in fact, it was like the main inspiration for the film. Who knew? The other thing that inspired Cornell to make this film was, in his own words, I went to a dog pound and I was shocked. I was like, how can they stay behind the fences and I'm in front and I'm part of this system? I felt ashamed. I immediately decided when I watched their eyes that I would like to do a movie. So, interestingly, animal shelters, the pound, animal shelters, which also factor into the novel Disgrace as well, animal shelters play a large role in this film, in White God, as well as the whole animal control department, in that, A, in real life, the dogs in the film were all taken out of shelters. Did I mention we're talking 250 dogs were in this film, and all 250 dogs were taken from either the shelters or off the streets. And these were shelters all around. Before the filmmakers cast these individuals, every one of them was languishing in a city shelter or was homeless on the streets. And that's the real aspect of the shelters playing a role in the film. But in the film itself, as I said, we first see an animal control officer demanding that Lily's father pay the fine or bring Hagen to the shelter, having been tipped off by this neighbor in the building. And the next time we see animal control officers, they're emerging out of their vans with catch poles in hand, and they're descending upon these homeless animals who were just congregating together in an abandoned lot. And, you know, they're obviously homeless, but the guys try to catch these homeless dogs. And they're not depicted in the brightest light. They're not depicted as cruel necessarily. They're just kind of more cold, just really unfeeling, just really not really compassionate towards the animals. They're just kind of doing their job. But they're not depicted as like evil, which I appreciate, because I wouldn't say there's no real black and white. There's a little black and white because the dog fighters are pretty awful, and they are depicted as awful, and they're awful. So I don't mind that so much, because they really are doing some horrific things to these animals, and they're just so desensitized to the animals, and it's awful. So that I don't mind, because it's not just a one-dimensional depiction. It's actually a very realistic depiction. But the shelter workers, or not the shelter workers, in this case, the animal control officers, they're kind of in this grayer area, because they're not evil, but they're unfeeling and cold. And it's almost like they have this personal vendetta against the dogs. Like, it becomes this battle of the wills, like a battle between who's the most clever and shrewd and fast, right? The dogs or the animal control officers. So it becomes for them almost this personal need to win, to be victorious over the dogs, who of course are trying to not be caught. So, and that's true on one hand. On the other hand, this is what's so interesting to me about this movie too, because I've talked about this before. These are the ones who are tasked with cleaning up the mess that society has created, that the government has created by enacting this really stupid arbitrary law about mixed breeds. And so who does it fall to but animal control to clean up the problems the city and people have created? They have to capture the homeless dogs and bring them to the shelter. So clear once again, right? The animal rights campaign remains a human project from beginning to end. We create this mess and we have to fix it. Without the humans making a mess of these things, other humans wouldn't have to intervene. So that's kind of my take on the animal control officers. You don't want them to catch the dogs, and yet they are bringing them to the shelter to be adopted out into homes. I mean, we see that in another scene. We see Lily go to the shelter at one point when she's looking for Hagen, and she talks to one of the shelter managers. And she's very suspicious of and very antagonistic toward the shelter worker there. And she accuses her of rounding up the dogs to kill them. And the shelter worker assures Lily that they do not kill the dogs they bring to the shelter, that they bring to the shelter. And yet a couple scenes later, we see that same shelter worker euthanizing a dog. But it's important to note, and I'm not telling you anything, this is a very minor part of the plot, but it's to me a major part of the texture of the film and the theme of the film. But I'm not ruining anything for you. But we see this shelter worker euthanizing a dog. And yet it's a very sad and tender moment. We can hear her saying very gently and very compassionately to the dog, "You won't have any enemies where you're going. No one will hurt you." So of course we're uncomfortable with the fact that, you know, it's very sad a dog is being euthanized. We don't know why. We don't know anything about the dog. And of course we're uncomfortable with the fact that she lied to Lily. But for me, again, it highlights this really difficult situation that we've created, where kind, compassionate human beings who are trying to help animals are the ones who have to kill perfectly healthy animals because of these issues that we've created and that we continue to exacerbate. So that's at least the lens through which I saw that. I didn't see her as like, oh my God, she's evil. She lied to Lily. She's a horrible person. They really are killing the animals. It was done in this very compassionate way. And I think that characterizes this just difficult situation that we are in terms of taking care of our society's other beings, in this case, domesticated dogs and cats, where there's overpopulation. So once again, I just really appreciate the thoughtful depiction of people and issues in this film. Now, I don't want to say too much more about the film itself, because I really want you to experience it on your own. But I want to say a few things about the inclusion of dogs in a movie that relied on real animals and not CGI. There's basically no CGI in the film. There's one I could tell you about after you've seen the film. I don't want to tell you about it right now. But it's not even worth mentioning, because it's really not. It's kind of semi-CGI. But really, the entire film is shot with all of these live animals. And the director talked about how he really wanted to depict the emotions of these animals. And he didn't want to fake it. And he didn't want to presume that he knew how animals would be feeling and somehow try and replicate that. So he wanted to use actual dogs. Now, I said I've seen this movie 3 times, and I've watched it very closely for anything that would make me uncomfortable in terms of how the dogs would have been treated during the filming itself. And as I said, there are some difficult scenes to watch, including a dog fight. Did I mention the dog fight? No, well, I told you he was being trained for fighting, and then we do see a scene where 2 dogs fight. And watching the scene, it is so clear to me watching the scene that these dogs are not fighting. It's so clear that they're actually playing. But the elements of those scenes with these dog fights that make them so brutal are the film editing, the sounds, and the sound editing. In fact, all of the growling and like kind of vicious sounds that we hear during the dog fight were made by two sound engineers, like by two human voices in Sweden in a sound studio. I've also watched and listened to and read countless interviews with both the director and the main trainer, the dog trainer, on the film. And I very much believe that the highest standards were in place in working with these dogs. Now, for those of you who don't believe that dogs should be used in film at all, then you're just going to disagree with me on that point. But I do believe, and I believe this film is a testament to this, I do believe that dogs can be worked with on films in a way that is not harmful, but actually helpful. This film, White God, has clearly set the bar incredibly high in that, as I said, all of the dogs in the film came from shelters. And more than that, they were each and every one of them adopted into homes at the end of the filming. And most significantly, because of their work on this film, these animals became even more adoptable than they would have been had they just been staying, you know, languishing in the shelter. And Cornell, the director, talked about how depressed many of these animals were in the shelter, and they became alive, like they came alive working with the trainers and working with all the people. They were with people every day on set, and they received so much training. And of course, training is vital to a dog's emotional well-being. And again, if you don't know that, and if you don't think that, then you just don't know dogs, because you need to give dogs boundaries and train them for their own emotional well-being. And because of all the handling and all the attention and affection they got during the filming, this really shaped how these animals were able to be adopted out into loving homes. Very few shelters have the resources to train dogs, never mind socialize them. And so working on this film actually gave them the opportunity to be trained and socialized. I do think there are some things that are not black and white in our world, and sometimes we have to work with what we have to make the best of it. I do think that there is a great benefit to dogs, whether they're in shelters or in homes, who work in the sense of working on a film set or being therapy dogs or, you know, therapy cats, like people who bring their dogs and cats to nursing homes or to hospital wards or for disabled people or service dogs for the blind. Like, I absolutely do think there is a benefit to the animals. It's not just for the people, but it's actually for the animals as well. I've heard some animal advocates say that that's enslaving dogs, that even having dogs as companions is enslaving them, but I don't agree. Our development and evolution as humans is intertwined with that of dogs, and there's nothing that makes a dog happier than being with a loving person and in many ways pleasing that person. And I absolutely believe there are ethical, humane ways to do that. And that's the rub. Of course, there are lines that should be drawn. And I can draw those lines without contradicting myself. And that's why I believe that there aren't always hard and fast distinctions. I believe that there are ethical ways for a dog to be part of a film. But I have a problem with dogs or any animal being part of combat. You know, I don't believe animals should be in war. There are circumstances where I don't think animals should be absolutely used. Obviously, you know that about me. But do I think there is a way to ethically include dogs in a film in a way that is not only not harmful, but absolutely helpful? And I do think there is. And so I would love to see the filmmakers of White God to help raise the standards on film sets to make sure that animals are taken from shelters and adopted into homes if they're not already companions in someone's home. We've seen dogs like the little dog Uggie, who became an international star, this little dog Uggie, in that beautiful film called The Artist, a French film from a few years ago. It was this kind of silent film. It's an homage to silent film, and it was so beautiful. And that little I'm now blanking on his breed, whatever. He was a little terrier. He was the star of the film, and he just became an international star. And his human companion also happened to be his trainer, and he loved him to pieces. He lived with him. He was his dog, and he was the trainer, and he loved him all the way to Uggie's death. Uggie died not that long ago after his trainer had retired him from working on films. Right after The Artist, he retired him from working on films because he was older, and he wanted his last few years to just be a retired dog. And that's possible. I do think there are compassionate people who can make sure that dogs are protected while working on films. And I invite you to watch the film yourself. I also invite you to watch some of the interviews that I include on the show notes for today's episode at joyfulvegan.com. Today's episode has its own post, and you can comment, you can watch these interviews, you can listen to the interview with Terry Gross and the trainer. I think the best interviews, though, are with the trainer and the director, interviewed by some Slate magazine folks. The Slate magazine interviewers asked such thoughtful questions. It was so heartening to see journalists ask questions about the animals and about animal rights. And it was just really thoughtful. And they asked about specific scenes in the movie that they thought, how could you even film that without it, you know, the dogs being in danger? And the trainers talk about it. And I would invite you to watch those interviews after you see the film, just so that you don't have any, there aren't any spoilers. And you'll hear the director and trainer talk about that. So for me, it's just clear to me that the well-being of the dogs was in the forefront of their minds every time. They used doubles, just like when babies work on films. Children under a certain age have to have a double. I don't remember what the age is. And that's the case with Hagen. His character in the film is played by two dogs, Bodhi and Luke, I think his name was. So that was something they were mindful about. As I said, all of the violence on screen was safely simulated. They would film with the dogs in small stretches. They never overworked them. They would only film for like a little bit over here, and then like they would take a break the rest of the day, and they would film a little bit over here again at the end of the day. And here was one of the first indications that I saw that the filmmakers were incredibly conscious about the animals while making this film. You wouldn't have seen this if you're one of those people who leave before the credits are over, but I'm someone who watches the credits to the very end because I feel that they're part of the movie. The credits are the part of the whole experience. The opening credits, which is why I cannot stand when people are talking during the opening credits of a movie. That's when the movie begins, is when those credits begin, and the movie ends at the very last tiny little logo at the end of those credits. Anyway, so as I said, in the beginning of the movie, maybe I didn't say this. The beginning of the movie, we learned that all of the dogs were adopted out and were from shelters. I mean, I know I told you that, but that was put on the opening credits in the very beginning of the movie. But there were several things in the credits themselves that were so moving, these end credits. One of them was during the rolling credits when the music starts, and after the music starts, because I told you that it was very silent for the first rolling credits. But once the music begins, one of the first credit titles was Our Dog Colleagues. I don't think I've ever seen that as the title of a credit, and I watch credits. It just indicated the thoughtfulness and the sensitivity to their relationship with the dogs on the film that I'd never seen before. And of course, it names the main characters' names, the real names, the, like I said, Bodhi and Luke, and then there are two other dogs who kind of play a more significant role, and then there's the 250 dogs, right? And so later on in the credits, you see a title that says, To Our Dog Friends. And it says, through our adoption program, these dogs found new families after the shoot. And then it names every individual animal. And I just find that so moving because every single one of these animals is an individual. Every single one of these dogs is an individual with a name and now a home and a life. And I found it so moving. And of course, at the very end, after that, there is also the disclaimer that says no animals were harmed. I'll read you exactly what it says. No animals were mistreated. This is different than your typical American Humane Association stamp, right? This is its own language. It says, no animals were mistreated or injured while training and filming. The strictest Hungarian and American guidelines were followed. All violence was safely simulated, certified by White Cross Animal Protection Society. The White Cross Animal Protection Society is the main animal protection society in Hungary. Now, for those of us who know that the American guidelines may be questionable, we look at this and we go, well, is that good enough, right? And of course, this is what I'm going to cover in the next podcast episode. But one of the problems with the American Humane Association, this disclaimer at the end of films, is not necessarily the guidelines themselves, but the lack of enforcement of these guidelines. So in the case of White God, I do believe that they take these guidelines and these standards and they go beyond. I think they reach the highest standards and beyond. And I think they can act as a model for other films. I have reached out to the filmmakers of White God. I've heard back from someone associated with it, and I'm waiting to hear back from one of the producers. And I will keep you posted on this. I will share any answers I receive from the filmmakers to questions I have for them. But I really think there's something exciting in terms of what could be done in terms of the role they could potentially play on standards in films. So One of the things I'm heartened by is, as I said, so many interviewers and film reviewers and journalists asking about the animals themselves and asking about the animal rights theme in this movie. And one of the questions the director has been asked a lot is about whether or not he's an animal rights advocate. And here's what he said to one interviewer. You may even see this in one of the clips that I share with you. He said, yeah, I grew up with dogs, and so I have a really good memory of that. I think it's really healthy to grow up with dogs, but I forgot it. So after I was living in the countryside, I grew up in the country, and then I went to Budapest to university, I lost that. I can't say I was a huge animal rights fighter, but now I am, totally. On the one hand, I'm an animal rights fighter because of the animals, but on the other hand, because of society. I would like to live in a society where animals have rights. I passionately believe in equality. We share the earth with everything that's alive. As humans, we easily forget it. It's really stupid. It's almost the most simple thing that you can share with others. It's primitive. And he goes on. And he says, I tell the story of animals, a dispossessed species that was once man's best friend, but man has betrayed them, and in turn they revolt against their former humans and companions in order to validate their existence. My intention was to demonstrate that mankind and animals share the same universe, only if we are able to position ourselves in the place of different species do we have the chance to lay down our arms. For the animals. Thank you to the filmmakers of White God. And for the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening.